Yeah. Oh, sure, yeah.
If you don't know, on Thursday night we have a practice group here, and there's about four or five sort of core facilitators, but we'd like to invite more people to come and facilitate if you want. So if you have like a couple years of practice, it's really very simple, and it's sort of just holding the space for people. So if you're interested in doing that or just finding out what it entails, come and see me. And the second one is a little strange, but tricycle, which is sort of the biggest Buddhist magazine about the Buddhist stuff, has contacted me, and they're looking for groovy Buddhists to profile in sort of a Q&A fashion over the course of a year. And so if you have a couple years of practice and you identify yourself as a Buddhist with the it, you can come to me.
Especially groovy Buddhists.
Yeah.
Of which I am most definitely not. Okay. So we tend to spend so much of our lives fixated on what's going on in the world around us, providing ourselves with our careers, our relationships, our friendships, focusing on providing ourselves with the essentials like food, clothing, shelter, medication, and all the other inessentials. Our minds are set up to be very externally focused, and the outside world is filled with a lot of motion and change. There's always a lot going on. And so when we settle down to meditate, one of the first things that we experience is often a sense of surprise, bordering on dismay at just how busy our minds are. Because there's so much going on in the world around us, we tend to have this feeling that there's not that much going on often inside. We can even feel sometimes that the mind is like a cipher, simply taking what's going on out there, filtering it and bringing it in and making decisions. And then when we close our eyes and try to sit in the body, we become immediately sometimes thrown by just how many thoughts and perceptions and how much movement there is in the mind. It's a little bit like if you've ever been in a canoe and you stop paddling and you look up at the clouds and the clouds are moving and you lose track of the fact that the canoe itself is floating. And then when you stop looking at the clouds, the canoe might have moved quite a lot. There's this constant energy that's going on and stress in the body that we're not aware of because we're so caught up in the world around us, caught up in what people think about us, caught up in all the things we have to do, we have to accomplish. And so the process of developing a daily meditation practice or a regular meditation practice can be one that's frustrating because we're often caught off guard by just how difficult it is to train the mind, how busy the mind becomes. The mind is not actually really, through evolution, is not set up really to be peaceful and calm. From a survival standpoint, being happy is way down the list of importance. After keeping your ass alive, you know, long enough to procreate, if that's what you want to do. But that's what has been privileged through evolution, is the mind's worrying, planning centers. The mind privileges those and gives the vast abundance of its neurotransmitters, dopamine, over to rewarding us for worrying and planning, scheming, and thinking of all the shoulds and oughtas and couldas and the way we believe that the world should be. So there's a lot of movement and motion in the mind, and we just don't really notice it because we're so caught up in the stuff outside of ourselves. And then when we sit and we meditate, it can be somewhat startling just to notice how difficult it is to settle down. Some people are lucky, and in their early practice they can settle down very quickly, but there will come a time, I guarantee you, in your practice where you will find it very, very difficult, very, very challenging. The important thing to remember is that people who have a spiritual practice are actually people who are on a path, a very, very valuable path. Most of the ways that people live their lives are they're trying to get from one moment to the next, trying to make it as pleasurable as they can. Some people are always going for the next thing that will make them feel as good as they quickly can feel good without any idea of how these actions will pay off in the long term. For example, when we're stressed out, some people immediately rush to the bar to get drunk without any thought of the fact that they're training themselves to need alcohol to deal with stress. It's just, I'm feeling uncomfortable, I need an immediate solution. The world we live in actually is very tied to immediacy when you think about it. I mean, I remember when computers first came out, you know, every year, a couple of years, they would double in speed. My first Mac was like 1990, and you couldn't run anything on that machine now that you'd do. I think the entire Mac Plus had 10 megabytes of storage space. And the original dial-ups for the Internet in 1995, when I first got on the Internet, everybody was on 56K. Now, if you put me on a 56K machine, I wouldn't even bother. I wouldn't even know what to do with it. I remember the first time I was on one that was 256. I was like, oh, my God, this thing flies, you know. Every couple of years, the speed of computers double, the speeds of dial-ups and hookups double. I recently saw a young girl have a nervous breakdown in an airport because she couldn't get Facebook on her smartphone. And I was thinking, well, I know I'm old, but it wasn't just more than 3 years ago when nobody had smartphones and there wasn't even a Facebook, you know? And now you can't live without something that up until 3 years ago didn't even exist. So we're like this. We need immediacy of solving every problem, everything. We need immediacy of our friends. We want to know exactly what they're doing and thinking all the time. When I joined Facebook, I was shocked at the things people were sending out. I cooked the best macaroni and cheese. Okay, good for you. So we need to know everything that our friends are thinking and doing, and there's nothing wrong with being in touch, but sometimes it gets ridiculous. So, and we begin so used to be able to taking pills and having immediate short-term solutions that we become less able to understand that certain things don't have immediate short-term feel-good feelings, but in the long term they cultivate peace and serenity and calmness. We're so caught up in the stuff that feels good, regardless of what it's going to make us feel like tomorrow, and we're not really trained to look at the stuff that, you know, like the gym. You go to the gym the first few months, you're just not going to notice any difference in your body. It's going to take a long time to develop any core muscle strength or any kind of definition. You know, people expect almost immediate results everywhere in their lives. I was talking with a tattoo artist friend of mine the other day, and I was explaining to him this concept that certain things we think about are junk food thoughts, that they feel good to think about, like, what are people thinking about me? What's going to happen to me? How much money do I have? You know, wouldn't it be great if I had this? These are junk food thoughts. They don't lead to lasting peace of mind. They train the mind to feel that there's something missing. They train us to feel like the answer to our happiness is always somewhere else in the future, that we're not allowed to be happy right here and now. And that, but these thoughts taste good, so we chew on them even regardless of what the way they make us feel in the long term. And it's the same thing with actions. You know, we train ourselves to do the first thing that will make us feel good regardless of the long-term outcome. And the tattoo artist said, oh, yeah, I call that eating the burrito. I said, eating the burrito? And he said, yeah, that's when you sleep with your ex-girlfriend. That's eating the burrito. It seems like... He said to me, it seems like a good idea when you're eating the burrito. But for the next 2 days, it's a terrible idea after that. So you get the idea. We're all very used to eating the burrito. And so having a spiritual practice is definitely not eating the burrito. It's it's eating broccoli, vegetables, leafy green vegetables. You know, it's doing your exercises when you don't feel like doing it. It's basically doing something that you often can't see right then and there, the value of what you're doing. And this, in the Pali Canon, the Buddha's recorded teachings, there's a lot of instances. There's one instance of a monk who was so frustrated with his lack of progress and the fact that his mind was still busy that he was about to quit the monastery. And there's a whole long talk where the Buddha talks about learning to practice your meditation like you're tuning a lute, not being too hard with yourself, not being too lax with yourself. But most of all, he talked about patience. But in the other cases, in the Pali Canon, the Buddha made it very clear that this tendency to want immediate results and to get discouraged almost just, you know, so quickly when we settle down, we're like, okay, I know that meditation and having a spiritual practice and refraining from lying and unskillful actions, I know that these are important things for me because I've seen in the past when I don't do them that I become agitated and worried. But this is hard, so I don't really want to do it. So that kind of thinking the Buddha talked about is actually something that we really should pay attention to. And he gave a series of what he called recollections that help when we get frustrated. There's another great image in the Pali Canon where he talks about a monk sitting alone on a mountainside right above a town when they're having a celebration and all the people are singing and dancing and getting drunk and having great times, and the monk is sitting there feeling really at an impasse in his practice, like, why am I doing this? You know, those fuckers down there are having a great time. And, you know, I'm up here meditating, and, well, everybody, you know, is down there at the bar, you know, getting drunk and having a great old time. And why am I practicing all this stuff? What's the point? So there's these reflections, and I'm just going to go over some of them with you. There's actually 10, and I'm not going to go over all 10. But I'm going to go over a few of them. So if you're ever having any problem and with frustration in your practice, these thoughts are worthwhile thoughts to reflect upon. before I list them, I'd also like to say, if you're starting your practice, it's really helpful at home to take advantage of the internet and go on the web and just listen to Dharma talks and sit with them. It's much easier to do that, download them to your iPod. Trying to sit in silence until you have worked out a really good process of meditating is about the most difficult way you can teach yourself. It's much easier to, when you're on those mornings or evenings when you're meditating alone, to do it to a monk. And I'll be happy, at the end of the class, I'll list some of the sites that have particularly good ones. The first recollection is called Buddhanusati, and that's simply the reflection of all the, first of all, the fact that the Buddha did attain lasting inner peace, that lasting inner peace is possible, but that it took a lot of effort. The Buddha had to spend 6 years alone, pretty much, in the jungle to attain his aha moment. 6 years. He basically lived in extreme deprivation for much of it. He was trying to forge a path that, you know, few had believed was possible. Basically, lasting inner peace, regardless of how much money or wealth or friends or anything you have. He wanted an inner peace that was not contingent upon anything beyond your control, something that you could always have. So it took him a lot of effort. And so it's worth reflecting on that, that nobody in the canon, nobody that I've ever studied, none of the monks that I've met, have ever reported that it was easy. On the other hand, all of them say it's worth it. It's worth it. So it's not going to be something that, when you settle down, is going to happen quickly. It's going to be something that's going to, there's going to be impasses. There's going to be times when you're not going to feel like there's progress. There's going to be times when you feel like, why am I doing this? I started my meditation feeling depressed, and I'm still depressed. The practice is, though, you're doing something that is so skillful. You're training yourself to be able to not react from fear. You're training yourself to be able to sit and see and observe the mind. You're training yourself to be able to see how you're adding unnecessary stress and suffering to your life. You're training yourself how, without having access to anything outside of your breath and your body, how to achieve peace and calm. All these things are amongst the most valuable things you can teach yourself. It's worthy of reflecting that most people live their lives chasing after these immediate happinesses or pleasures, and to the degree that they have any long-term goal or any long-term plan that they're working towards, these goals tend to be entirely external. Some people say, I'll be happy when I have a family, when I'm married, when my career is settled. I'll be happy when my novel is read by millions, when my painting is admired by all, when my acting finally achieves its audience, when I have 1,000 friends on friends Facebook. But all of these things have one thing in common. They're all external goals. And this is why people have something called midlife crises. Why? Because when you achieve these goals, you start to notice something, that they don't address any of the inner stress in the body and in the mind that we're creating. You can have a family. You can have a novel that sells to millions and a movie that's playing in movie theaters, if there still are movie theaters in the future. You can have your painting up in a gallery or in a museum. You can have CDs admired by millions of music fans. And still, all of those things are external accomplishments. There'll still, though, be this inner feeling of stress inner feeling of the mind being dissatisfied and moving around. Because this inner stress is not placated by anything external. It's caused by the way we use our mind, not by anything outside of the mind. So if you want to end that feeling of what's the point, why am I here, what am I doing with my life, the answer's got to come primarily from within. Which is not to say that we can't have external goals. The external goals are wonderful. I encourage you all to want to fix the world. God knows it needs fixing. But if you don't have any additional effort that goes into addressing the inner stress and discomfort that you're creating, then all of the work you do outside will feel empty, because you'll still have all this feeling of discomfort in your own skin. And that's why people who become extremely famous and successful still have nervous breakdowns and career doubts and midlife crises, because they haven't addressed the inner feelings that are underlying everything that they're doing externally. We have to at least balance our efforts so that we're also working on what's going on inside of us. So the second reflection is Dhammanusati, which is simply reflecting that the cause of our suffering and the cause of our peace are our own actions, our own thoughts. If, for instance, when we settle down and we meditate, we find that we're really harsh and judgmental with ourselves, it's because we've been overly critical with other people in our lives. We're constantly judging. You can't have a mind that's filled with judging and criticism and then expect it to be all kind and gentle with yourself. It doesn't work that way. Whatever thoughts you nourish in your day-to-day life, that's what you're stuck with. That's what you're nourishing. That's really what karma, or karma in Pali, boils down to. Your actions and your thoughts are what you're going to live in, and you're creating the mind that you're living in. If you're living in a mind that is frustrated, that constantly feels you need more, then no matter what you accomplish in your meditation, you're not going to be satisfied. If, on the other hand, you live in a mind that is one that is generous with other people, or is compassionate, or is patient with other people, then when you settle into your mind, you'll find that it will be more patient with yourself. You're building the mind that you live in the future, by your actions and your thoughts that you have right now. That's the long-term repercussions that the Buddha was talking about with karma. It's, we are creating our own minds, the landscape that we live in. And that is the stress and the suffering that will be, and the peace and the sense of joy that we'll be living in the future. It's entirely authored by our own thoughts and our own actions. So reflecting on that, and then reflecting on that the Buddha did come up with a set of easy-to-follow instructions or a path. And not only the Buddha, there are other spiritual paths as well. You don't have to be a Buddhist. You don't have to be in this path. There are other spiritual paths. But so long as you're on a path, I guarantee you, you won't wake up one day when you're in your 50s having painted your masterpiece and still feeling, what the fuck did I do all this work for? Like, what's the point? You'll know what all your efforts are going into. You know why you're alive. You'll know what you're trying to accomplish in your life, which is to not cause yourself unnecessary stress and suffering, to bring about peace with yourself and peace with the people around you, so that you don't have to add any more suffering to life. I mean, life is filled with loss. People die, we all get old, we all get sick, we get separated from the people we love. So why would you want to add more stress and suffering to that? So that's the real point. If you're asking me if you want to know what the point of life is from a Buddhist perspective, start with the idea that why not stop adding any suffering and stress to your life and add as much peace and tranquility into your inner experience as you can, so that you can have a good foundation within which to react to everything that's happening around you. The third reflection is Sangha Nusati, which means reflecting on the fact that you're not alone, that there are, even though most people in the world might be looking for the answer to all their problems in the material, they might be constantly hunting down more money, more friends, more fame, that there are other spiritual practitioners out there in the world. And if you find that you've gotten way off track in your practice, there are people that you can talk to. And that you can also reflect on the fact that if you look around here, there are people here who are just as economically challenged, as I'm sure we all are, who are just as worried about, you know, how they're going to pay the rent in New York, who are just as challenged and just as, you know, have just as much responsibility, and still they're practicing and still they're putting the effort in. That's really the power of Sangha Nusati, which is it really makes us see that we're not alone. When we open up and share with another spiritual practitioner the difficulties we experience, the mistakes we make, and the triumphs we have, we bond and we see that we're not alone in this endeavor. And that helps give us the energy and the desire to keep putting effort into our practice. The fourth is Kagha Nusati, which means reflecting on any generosity, any time that we've acted with compassion and generosity. And the value of this is a couple-fold. There's a lot of clinical studies that show that the more we reflect on our generosity, the more we focus on being generous, the happier we are in the long term. There's a whole book called The Happiness Hypothesis that has a lot of clinical data about the long-term effects of being generous. And it's worthwhile to reflect on generosity because it makes you more, part of your spiritual practice. You're going to want to have more examples, more fresh material to reflect on. And believe me, when you reflect on times that you've acted selflessly, that you've helped others, that you felt rewarded for something you've done, it also does something very powerful, which is you don't have to run around and get acknowledgement from others when you do something skillful. For a long period in our lives, when we do something that's helpful, we need to run around and find somebody and say, guess what I just did? You know, I just walked an old woman across the street. It was amazing. I'm a spiritual powerhouse. And the problem is that when we do that, actually we're draining all the long-term good feelings from it because we're basically simply doing that to gain acknowledgement, and we're making our sense of happiness and reward contingent upon other people acknowledging it and saying, yeah, you're a great guy. That's amazing. You stopped and helped somebody. If we stop doing that and we learn to give ourselves the reward for our good actions, then we never have to worry about getting that sense of fulfillment. It's not contingent upon anybody else. And once we do that, all the other endeavors in our lives, we become able to reward ourselves. We don't have to, if we write a song or paint a painting or whatever, we don't have to get somebody to immediately reward us. We can get a sense of fulfillment ourselves. But it starts by reflecting on our generosity, the times that we've been selfless. Those are the times that bring us the biggest sense of long-term self-esteem. And also, reflecting on generosity is something that can never be taken away from you. It's not an exhaustible resource. It's always available. You can always reflect on it. This doesn't take anything away from anyone else. The fifth reflection is Sila Nusati, which is reflecting on the times that you acted virtuously and not out of unskillfully. Basically, a lot of the practices that the Buddha asks us to maintain, and any spiritual practice asks us to maintain, like refraining from lying and stealing, especially lying and not speaking just through gossip and through just meaningless people-pleasing speech. This takes a lot of effort. A lot of people learn to survive their childhoods by lying. We grow up in environments where we don't get the love and the attention we need. So as coping strategies, we learn to get what we need by exaggerating, by lying, by throwing fits, by demanding. And we train ourselves that that's the only way we'll get what we need, by acting in such a way with our parents. Because if we don't, we believe that our parents will not pay attention to us and we won't get our needs met. So it takes a lot of effort to undo these coping strategies as adults and to trust ourselves and to train ourselves that we'll still get people interested and we'll still get the attention we need by not exaggerating, not by lying. We'll get what we need not by not trying to get over with other people. So it takes a lot of effort. And we should reflect on those times when we refrain from taking the easy way out, from acting unskillfully, from telling a white lie, or avoiding somebody that we needed to have a conversation with, or by just, you know, saying anything to please someone so that we don't have to go through a difficult engagement. Reflecting on those times that we've acted skillfully is extremely rewarding in terms of building up self-esteem. And it also gives you something, by the way, that is priceless. If I can't pay you to steal or kill, you have something that's priceless, right? If somebody would offer you $1 million and you would refuse to kill for $1 million, then you have something that's worth $1 million, your virtue. That's something to reflect on. That's something that actually has realness to it. It's not an abstract idea. The fact that you are willing to forego doing what so many other people do under the false belief that that's the only way they can survive, then you have really accomplished something worthwhile and notable. Finally, kayagatasati, which is reflecting and bringing your awareness time and again into the body. Reflecting and noticing how you're breathing, noticing where you're carrying your stress. Every time we do this, it detaches from all those thoughts of discouragement and despair. Why aren't I already Gandhi? Why aren't I already achieving lasting inner peace and happiness? I've been meditating for all 2 weeks. I should be a monk by now. What's going on? If you practice kayagatasati, which is time and again throughout the day, just bringing your awareness into your body, cultivating having a calm breath, reflecting on which areas you carry your stress, and learning how to use the breath to relax your body, you'll have an immediate way to detach from your thoughts. And it's your thoughts that cause so much of your stress and suffering. So having an immediate tool that at any moment of the day can whisk you out of fear, can whisk you out of frustration, can whisk you out of disappointment, can make your awareness that much bigger, that's an extremely valuable spiritual tool. So practice, even when you're not meditating, finding a place in your body where you can reside and noticing the places in your body where you carry your stress. So those are the 6 out of the 10 reflections. Reflections on the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, generosity, virtue, and the body itself. I hope that one of those come in handy, and I thank you for listening tonight. Now it's your turn to ask any questions or anything about the spiritual path that you'd like to know more about. Hi.